So often, you know, when we think about Dharma practice, a lot of us have been conditioned to think about it primarily in terms of meditation, you know. And often when I talk with students, you know, I'll say, you know, how's your practice? And they'll say, you know, oh, it's not very good, or, you know, and, you know, I'll say, like, what does that mean that your practice is not very good? And they'll say, oh, I forget to do it, you know. And what they mean is I don't make time for sitting, or I don't sit as long as I would like, or as regularly. But there's really been a message that's been taught, you know, mostly unconsciously, but in the many of the westernized Buddhist traditions, the convert Buddhist traditions, that that practice means sitting in meditation. And then we say, you know, practice in everyday life as if it's, you know, the sort of the extracurricular almost, or the like, oh, that's, you know, now I really want to talk about bringing my practice into my whole life. And again, there can still be the sense that sitting in meditation is the practice, and I'm bringing the practice into my everyday life, like, i.e. my non-sitting still life. And this is exacerbated by a culture that that is starting to think of meditation in a very transactional way, that the purpose of meditation is to be less stressed. And the implied purpose of being less stressed is, of course, to be happier, but is also to be more productive and, you know, things like that. And it's true that meditation can help you be happier and less stressed and more productive, maybe. I'm not actually sure if that's worked for me, but happier for sure. More productive, I'm not sure. But that certainly is not its purpose in the Buddha's teachings. Its purpose is far vaster than like temporal well-being, that deep meditation, and here I'll define meditation temporarily as states of profound centeredness in the heart and mind and body, that there's something extraordinary about these states that are life transforming, that are radical and strange, and are not just a support for happiness, but are actually a support for something far more mysterious, which we kind of conventionally in you know, Buddhist language call, you know, freedom or liberation or awakening. But all of those are kind of metaphors. And, you know, what does that really mean? But we've learned, many of us, to think of sitting in meditation as that's what practice is. And that then the purpose of that partly is to support the rest of our day in being better. So without dismissing this, like, that's fine, right? Meditation is supportive of the rest of the day. I want to flip that as an experiment here as we start the year. And I want to propose that deep meditation, so really centering the mind and heart in states of profound stillness and receptivity, openness and ease, and vastness. These are all a little different, but they all touch on the free from unintentional thought, free from disorganized energy, quite gathered states. The Dharma word, the Buddhist word, will be samadhi in both Pali and Sanskrit. that these states of meditation are deeply healthy and transformative for our entire psyche. And it's not that they are good at helping us be less stressed. It's actually that they are good in and of themselves for deep well-being. What if then we think about our Dharma practice as doing what we need to do to bring about those states, rather than those states being what we need to do in order to not be insane, in late capitalism. And I'm going to propose that both of those things work, like it works both ways. Meditation will help you to be less insane living in late capitalism. But something interesting happens when we say, how can we set up the conditions in our lives as best we can for states of profound ease, joy, bliss, and centeredness to be available to us? So for the next bit of time here in this group, I'm going to begin a series looking at meditation, but I want to start kind of at the beginning with meditation is a state. Meditations are states, and we want to set up the conditions for those states to be possible and strong. And so the first condition I want to talk about tonight is sleep. All right. So one of the things that we find in meditation right away, we bring the body into stillness, we set down whatever we're thinking about, we relax, and very quickly we will be confronted with, in many cases, but at least aware of, the energetic tone in our body, really in the body, in the nervous system, in the emotional body. And this energetic tone, like we did in the meditation, is going to be, you know, somewhere on a spectrum, and it's not necessarily linear, right? There's a whole web of energetic expressions that can come through, but you can think of them generally on a spectrum of, you know, low energy to high, where the extreme low energy states can be thought of as the unskillful or not useful for meditation, certainly, or well-being, states of like dullness, deep sleepiness in a kind of foggy way. You know, sleepiness could just mean like you're tired and you should go to sleep, and yes, you should. So that's partly what the talk is tonight. Go to sleep. But sleepiness in that way that's not just like I should take a nap, but is more like, you know, I can't focus, I can't really think clearly. I'm actually like underslept in a sort of deep way, the kind of exhaustion state. So there's a low energy that's like that. Low energy doesn't mean it's quiet, like it could be quite buzzy and yucky. You know what that's like. All the way up to an unskillful high energy state that's like, you know, restless, fidgety, buzzing in a kind of like amped or hyper kind of way, unable to settle. And often that side, and in a way, both extremes of the energetic spectrum, the unskillful low and the unskillful high, they can both actually be places where the mind doesn't easily settle. There can be a lot of thinking, a lot of wandering thought, a lot of anxious thought in either of those states. And then somewhere in the middle, of course, is a nice balanced energy state. And when we are in this state, it's often quite pleasurable, and it can be hard to notice. Like it, balanced energy might be a state that you think of as normal, even if you're not in it very much, such that when you land there, it might just occur to you that you're having a very nice day, and you might not notice the energetic state as much as you notice the other content that you're doing. Like you might be really engaged in what you're doing. You're out in the woods with your friends, or you're, you know, playing with your new puppy, or you're whatever. You're alert. You're doing a creative project. You're neither tired nor amped. You're in the sweet spot. And this sweet spot is going to be also the sweet spot for meditation. So when we come into meditation, one of the first things we'll notice is our energetic expression somewhere along that spectrum. And we know that the two, from the Buddha's teachings, that the two extremes are considered unskillful because we have them literally named as the third and fourth hindrances. So many of you will know, you know, the list of the hindrances. The first two are emotional in a certain way, sensual desire and hatred and ill will. So strong liking and strong disliking. And the third and fourth are energetic. The dullness side is often translated as sloth and torpor. And the restless, the high energy side is restlessness and worry. Both of these are ancient compound words in the Pali and Sanskrit, and often they're thought of as a compound between a mental quality and a physical quality. So like sloth and torpor, sloth is the old, you know, Victorian word for laziness. So it's a kind of mental dullness, unwilling to put in the work or really apply oneself to one's discipline. And torpor is more the physical, like sleepy, exhausted, dull, foggy, you know, murky kind of state. So together, they're two expressions of the kind of dull side of the energetic spectrum. And then restlessness and worry are the high end. And so restlessness is more the physical, jumpiness, in the body, unable to settle, and then worry or anxiety, we might say, in a more acute way, as the mental aspect of that, right? Unable to settle the thinking mind. And so the hindrances, one of the ways we can think of the hindrances is that they're hindrances to the body and mind being at ease. And so they are very much hindrances to settling in meditation, coming into samadhi, which is the name for these balanced, beautiful states. And so to come to that balanced energy, we need a few basic conditions to be met. And a first important thing that is always good to remember with many of these kinds of disciplines is that you can't do them by force of will. So you can't on purpose, just through willing it, you know, through like trying to think differently, shift your energetic state from dull to balanced, or from restless to balanced. You just like emotions, you can only affect these aspects of our state indirectly, and you do them by changing the conditions, right? So if I feel really dull, I can't tell myself to wake up. But I could get up and, you know, do a bunch of jumping jacks, change my physical state, and I'll wake up. You know, I could go take a cold shower and I'll wake up. You know, I could, you know, breathe really fast in and out, and I'll wake up. If I'm really restless, I can't actually force myself to calm down, but I could go for a walk around the block, and as I walk, like slowly just slow my pace in a way that just feels natural. Just let the energy kind of burn through and move a little bit and kind of circle around toward a more balanced stillness. You know, I could do some breath work practice where I emphasize long breaths and really relaxing. And again, any of these kinds of practices, they don't change your state automatically or directly. They do it indirectly. So then we can think about what are the conditions or the indirect levers that we have for affecting our state and bringing our state toward something that is going to be more helpful for us. And as a side note here, I think it's important to say that you know, there are types of meditation, including some types of mindfulness and, you know, things descended from Vipassana and things descended from Zazen, the Zen meditation style, that, you know, emphasize not applying interventions, that really emphasize just noticing what's here without judgment and without trying to change it. And so I want to give a bow to those methods. The way I hold those kinds of instructions is that, you know, when I sit down to meditate, I've essentially done all of the setting up of conditions that I'm going to do for this meditation. So as I come into stillness, there's no more sleep that I could get. There's no different food that I could eat. There's no different lighting to do. There's no different cushions. All of that has already happened, right? I've set up the conditions as best I can. I've arrived in stillness. And then once you're there, you get what you get. Or as we tell the kiddos, you get what you get and you don't get upset, which is not exactly correct. Because you get what you get and you might get upset, but you get what you get. And whether you're upset or not, we don't want you to complain about it, is what we're really saying. But, you know, you sit down in meditation and then your energy is whatever it is. Your emotions are whatever they are. And what you are experiencing is the result. The term would be the karmic or comic result. It sometimes is rather comic, haha. But it's a comic, K-A-M-M-I-C, comic result of your previous actions, right? So if I got a good night's sleep, my energy will be a certain way. If I stayed up till 2 a.m., you know, lost in a YouTube vortex, my energy will be different, right? And part of our work then is to understand the conditions that give rise to well-being and to cultivate them. So a bit about sleep then. I think sleep, along with food, and I'll talk about food a little later this month maybe, but sleep really is perhaps the single most powerful lever we have in working directly with our energy levels. How we sleep will directly influence our energy levels, which themselves are directly connected to our ability to focus. There's a lot of data points you can find in for this. This isn't going to be one of those talks where I read you statistics about how they did a study and that people who were underslept had a 10 times worse reaction speed on some test than people who were well slept. Things like that. Here's a book that you can look at for a lot of good information on this and other things. Stolen Focus by Johann Hari. I'm saying Johann. I actually don't know how he pronounces it, but it's smart. It has all of the data points that you need for that, and the subtitle is Why You Can't Pay Attention. So, you know, if that's you, go get it. It was me. And I want the data points, so I went and got it. And I'll say more about that book maybe in future gatherings. But the chapter on sleep is really good, and it collates a bunch of information that many of you will have heard already, like the fact that sleep deprivation, that the symptoms of sleep deprivation are nearly identical to the symptoms of ADHD. And that some folks think that the prevalence of ADHD in children and teens a very large percentage of it is actually sleep deprivation, not some other underlying syndrome or disorder. But that sleep deprivation in youth is extraordinary and pervasive and deeply harmful and unhealthy. You know, the advice here is in a certain way very simple. It is get enough sleep. The general recommendation is for, you know, male-bodied people to be between like 7 and 8 hours a night and female-bodied people to be in the 8 to 9 hours range. And I don't know, that probably has to do not so much with what type of body you wear or were born with, but like relative amounts of, you know, various hormones in your system. So so I'm not too concerned with that being a, I don't want to get into the trouble of trying to parse that in a gendered way, but some bodies will need more sleep. That could be like 9 hours, and some bodies will need somewhat less sleep. But the general number that I've heard is that less than 6 or 7 is going to be poor for almost anyone. And that changes as we age and you know, as our bodies change. But to undercut that consistently over time has pretty terrible effects. And so so what if we think of our sleep hygiene as one of the main conditions that we can set in place for deep, wakeful, satisfying, pleasurable meditation, along with, you know, again, the other things that I'll add to that list are basically, along with sleep, are basically going to be food, like healthy food, good exercise, and social connection. That's my four requisites. So we'll talk about that a bunch through this month. But thinking about sleep, so most of us could sleep more. Most of us could sleep better. So it's not just about sleeping more, but particularly about reaching deep sleep, deep dreamless sleep, and then reaching the beautiful sleep called REM sleep that usually happens in the later part of the night, after deep dreamless sleep. And this is where dreaming happens. And if you, some of you will know that there's a whole wing of tantric Buddhist practice that begins with lucid dreaming and culminates in meditations that you do while you're asleep, including leading toward meditations where you can learn to maintain a kind of awareness throughout the entire night while sleeping, because you can learn to be aware of nothing, right? No sensory stimulus, which is what deep dreamless sleep essentially is giving your mind. So the pathway toward that, don't worry about that. It's quite distant for most of us non-extreme yogis, but the more accessible beginning to that is lucid dreaming, is learning to be conscious in while dreaming. And lucid dreaming can become a very beautiful arena for practice. Some of the teachers that teach this, mostly folks in the Tibetan tradition, you know, they'll sort of jokingly say, like, you know, if you can meditate in your dreams, like, how efficient is that? You get like an extra 2 hours of meditation practice every day, you know. But it's also just a beautiful, interesting practice in wisdom and ethics. I'm not going to talk a lot about lucid dreaming tonight. Maybe in a later one we'll talk about it. But, you know, one of the most interesting things for me in that practice is to notice how, you know, in my dreams, the situations arise that, you know, that are the most, you know, potent in the relational field, you know, sexy dreams, violent dreams, fearful dreams. And I'll notice how in my dreams, my dream self practices the precepts. So, you know, I've actually had sexy dreams where in the dream, I'm like, listen, you're very lovely, but, you know, my partnership is not open at the moment, so we can't actually go further than this, you know. And there's been moments where I wake up and I'm like, dude, it was a dream, but, you know. Kudos to my dream self for observing, you know, my partnership boundaries, you know, and other times when it's like, you know, I'm in an afraid dream, and I'll notice that it's a fearful dream, and I'll realize that I don't want to run anymore in the dream, or I don't want to do this violent thing that I might habitually have done in the dream. And you begin to become aware and conscious. But you can only really do this practice if you're sleeping long enough to actually dream. And one of the things that happens with people sleeping less and less is that folks dream less, because the dreams, you have to sleep for a while before you start dreaming. And so if you're waking up too early or going to bed too late, such that you're waking up exhausted in the morning, often that can cut off the dream time. So the advice for how to sleep longer and better, I think you've all probably heard it, or many of you will have heard it. You know, some of the primary advice is to drag your circadian rhythm a little bit closer to the sun. So not staying up till 2 a.m. on YouTube and Netflix. And, you know, folks doing this in an extreme way, you know, that you'll just notice that there are studies that show that artificial light, even a bit into natural dark, throws off your circadian rhythm a little bit. It throws off your natural sleeping and waking. I'm not going to be the kind of Dharma influencer that suggests that you turn off all your electric lights at sunset, which around here is about 5 o'clock at this time of year, and, you know, go through the evening with a couple candles, you know, telling stories around the fire until you naturally fall asleep and wake up at 5:30. I mean, yeah, do that, right? That's really nice. And, you know, the middle way that works for a lot of folks, works for me, when I can do it, I really notice the difference, is to, you know, to minimize strong artificial light, bright artificial light, especially whitish and blue lights, and especially screens, within about 2 hours of going to sleep time. And I just, you know, I don't want to be too like, follow my sleep rhythm. Like, there are, you know, the chronotypes, the owls and the larks. The owls are the stay up late and sleep late, and the larks are the go to bed early and wake early. So I'm not here to tell you that if you're an owl, you have to like try to wrench yourself into becoming a lark. But the encouragement is to investigate your relationship with light and dark, and your relationship with wakefulness and sleepiness, and really to notice how you, like, if your meditation is first thing in the morning, which it isn't for everybody, but for some of us it is, to just notice how your evening influences the next morning. And that's for all of these kind of like life reset fixes, rather than coming up with some program like, oh, I have to do this, I have to do it this way, you know, that's the right way, I saw it on YouTube, I gotta do it this way, whatever, you know. The thing that I would more encourage is to get curious about your day-to-day flow, and to really start to track. The primary discipline here is tracking, action and impact. Like, when you do this, what happens? And so for energy changes mostly in a day over day kind of way. So, like, you know, before you go to sleep, like, think about, what did I eat today? And, you know, how was my energy? And then, when am I going to sleep? And then, when do I wake up, and how do I feel, right? It doesn't have to be more complicated than that. But if you really want to start looking at your sleep, start to look at, how was the evening, and then how's the morning, right? What was my state like in the evening, and what was my state like in the morning? And, you know, we all know what it's like to stay up super late for whatever reason, sometimes wonderful reasons. There are wonderful reasons to stay up super late. And then you know how you feel the next day, right? And that's clear. And so as we start the year off, the encouragement here then is to respect sleep as one of the most important conditions for working with our energy and for creating the conditions for focus, for wakefulness, and for a really pleasure in meditation and throughout the rest of our day and productivity and all the rest. But I'm going to go for, you know, for excellent meditations in the morning, and then just begin to track when do I go to sleep, how deep is that sleep, how does it feel basically, and how do I wake up, when do I wake up, and what kind of energy do I wake up with. So starting the year off, sleep enough, sleep well, dream well. I'll talk in another evening soon. We'll do a little talk about lucid dreaming and some other aspects of practicing at night. But for now, we'll leave it there. So blessings. And again, if you're watching this in the mysterious future on YouTube, liking and subscribing helps the channel. And there's a donation link on our website, and it really supports the Sangha. So thank you for that.